From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America presents Issues in the News. The nation's top Washington correspondents offer their perspectives on the week's major stories.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Barbara Slavin, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. Joining me on the show this week are Stephen Collinson and Chris Moody, both reporters at CNN Politics. And here are the issues. Iran, using 1970s-era U.S.-made aircraft, bombed positions of the so-called Islamic State in Iraq, stepping up intervention on the same side as a U.S.-led coalition. In other Iraq news, the Baghdad government and the Kurdish regional government reached a deal on sharing oil revenues that will allow more oil to flow outside Iraq via a Turkish pipeline. In Russia, President Vladimir Putin delivered his annual State of the Nation address, defiantly affirming Russian claims to Crimea without explaining how Russia will contend with Western sanctions and falling oil prices that have weakened the Russian economy. In Egypt, a judge cleared ousted President Hosni Mubarak and his two sons of corruption charges. The prosecutor general said he would appeal the acquittals. Still, the likelihood is increasing that Mubarak, who has already spent 3 years in a military hospital, may be released soon. At the same time, another court sentenced 188 alleged supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood to death in connection with an incident in 2013 in which 11 police officers were killed. Finally, in the United States, protesters again took to the streets to denounce the failure of another grand jury, this time in New York, to indict a white police officer in the death of an unarmed black suspect. The victim this time, Eric Garner, had asthma, which contributed to his death when a policeman subdued him with a chokehold. Garner's last words, captured on a cell phone video, have become a rallying cry for protesters. Those words, quote, "I can't breathe," unquote. Gentlemen, we're going to start with Iraq, where we have an interesting situation. Reports for the first time that Iranian planes, actually they're old American planes, F-4 Phantoms, are bombing in the portion of Iraq that lies along the border with Iran. And Secretary Kerry was asked about this, Secretary John Kerry, at a conference in Europe, and he basically said, well, we're not coordinating with them, but I think it's self-evident, he said, that if Iran is taking on ISIL, which is what some in the government call the Islamic State, in some particular place, and it's confined to taking on ISIL and has an impact, it's going to be, the net effect is positive, unquote. What do you make of this?
Well, you know, it's just another example of how this conflict with ISIS has completely scrambled the established diplomatic and geopolitical sort of battle lines that have always seen, you know, the U.S. on the opposite side of Iran. So we now have the U.S. and Iran fighting the same group in Iraq. The Syria situation has also scrambled those battle lines. Iran supports Assad. The U.S. doesn't support President Assad, but they're both making moves against ISIS in Syria. So it just shows this very strange way in which the ISIS threat has sort of reshaped the geopolitics of the region. The U.S. insists that it isn't cooperating with Iran in any way. But it's difficult to think that, you know, if U.S. and Iranian planes are in the same airspace in Iraq, there is at least not some kind of tacit coordination going on.
Yeah, Chris, apparently the way it's done, and this was explained to me also when I was at a conference in Istanbul recently, we don't technically cooperate. The U.S. doesn't technically cooperate with Iran, but the U.S. talks to the Iraqis and the Iraqis talk to the Iranians. So it's only one removed, yeah?
Right. And in politics, super PACs don't technically cooperate with campaigns. I mean, it's a very kind of similar in a way. But you're right. Strange is the word that I would use here. But isn't that how foreign policy so often is, where the enemy of your enemy is your friend?
Sure.
I recall very recent memory, Congress talking about declaring some kind of war against Assad, and now we have to cooperate with them in certain ways. And you must, just for safety, if there are planes in
sure.
the air, targets of being bombed, there does have to be some kind of cooperation, even if that is an incredibly awkward situation for U.S. policymakers, just for safety and for getting the job done. But I think between Assad and between Iran, and then Iran using old United States.
Planes.
Airplanes,
yeah.
Puts everyone in a very interesting situation.
Yeah. Stephen, the verb they use is deconflicting. That's what the Iraqis do for us. They deconflict between us and the Iranians. But still, the ironies abound in this situation. Another way in which the U.S. government has been working with the Iranians has been by bolstering the Kurds. And the Kurds and the central government of Iraq have now finally reached an agreement that will restore budgetary payments to the Kurdistan regional government and also allow a certain amount of oil to be sold on behalf of Iraq writ large, and then they're going to split the revenues. The U.S. has been pushing for this for a very long time. I wouldn't be surprised if Iran was also supporting this kind of agreement. Can you talk a little bit about the nature of the dispute that had been going on and how they've resolved it?
ISIS, has managed to do what the U.S. government and the big oil firms couldn't do for months, which is get this deal together. And, you know, we're only a few months away from the Kurds saying that they wanted to declare independence. Now they've done a deal with the Abadi government in Baghdad. So it's very interesting how, you know, it's another case, as Chris was saying, of my enemy's enemy is my friend. And the U.S. tried to get the Iraqis to do this deal for several years. The Maliki government. And the problem always was, you know, the Maliki government didn't want to bolster the Kurds because that would bolster their attempts to have an independent state. Mm-hmm. This deal looks like a pretty good deal for the Kurds. The revenue they're going to get is going to be at least 5% more than it was under previous arrangements. The Iraqis have effectively turned a blind eye to the fact that a lot of these oil fields around Kirkuk are disputed. The Kurds actually use the ISIS conflict to sort of move into some of these areas. So I think it's a marriage of convenience that if the ISIS threat ever is neutralized and is no longer there, I think it's pretty likely we'll see the dispute between the centralized Iraqi government and the Kurds over oil revenues continue. But for the moment, at least, this seems to be something that's a product of the times, and both sides see it as in their interests to sort of pursue.
Yeah, Chris, Stephen mentioned the fact that the Kurds had taken over Kirkuk, which is a disputed city, profiting from the advances made by the Islamic State when they came in. They took Mosul and so on. As a result, there's what they call stranded oil. All the oil that's coming out of the area around Kirkuk, apparently it's not safe to send it out any other way. So they had to use a route that's provided by the Kurds, constructed relatively recently, that goes from the Kurdistan regional government areas to the port of Ceyhan in Turkey. So, yes, it's turned out to be of mutual benefit. And I think another factor is that the Kurds thought that their armed forces, the Peshmerga, could hold off any problems from the Islamic State, and they soon discovered that that was not the case. So the Kurds discovered that they really couldn't afford to go independent, and the Iraqis realized that they needed the Kurds to get their oil out.
It's a very promising sign what they did with this budget deal, and how often we forget that in a place of such turmoil, when we're always talking about disaster and talking about war, that these governments also have to deal with the same issues that the United States has to deal with, and that's balancing a budget, coming up with a budget deal, and the basic operations of government. And it's very difficult to launch a full-scale battle against insurgent forces, or whatever you might call them, when you can't even get your money issues in order. And I think this is really checking the box in a way that they needed to. And you had to have cooperation with people who have not cooperated very well, and that's with Baghdad and with Kurdistan. So, I think in the fight against ISIS, in the larger picture, this is really a positive step forward and something that they had to do and could not do under Maliki.
Yeah. Stephen, one other provision is that the Kurds will get more weapons to fight the Islamic State, which was one of their important demands. And you do get the sense, again, I was at this conference in Istanbul where you had the Kurdish Minister of Energy and the Iraqi Minister of Energy together on the same stage, and they were very companionable and they were calling each other by their first names. It was really striking to see this. But of course, there's a third element here. Iraq is not just Shiites and Kurds, it's also Sunni Arabs. Do you think that this agreement could be built on in such a way that it might appeal to Sunnis, that they will get a fair share of oil revenues and that there's a reason for them to come back into the fold?
Right. I mean, that's going to be the acid test of the Abadi government, whether he's able to be more accommodating to Sunni opinion in Iraq than the Maliki government was. U.S. officials basically believe that Maliki created a lot of this trouble by alienating, purging Sunni officers from the armed forces. So that's going to be the key, and it's probably a much more complicated test that the government faces. From the U.S. point of view, this oil deal, though, is very important because the whole thrust of U.S. strategy against ISIS is, first of all, try and make some advances in Iraq, deal with a problem in Iraq where the Iraqi forces are stronger than the opposition forces are in Syria, try to sort of keep the country together, push ISIS back into Syria, and then squeeze it that way. So the whole premise of President Obama's strategy is based on doing Iraq first, if you like. So from the fact that the Kurds are going to get more money to build up their forces, that there's more cooperation between the central government and Iraqi Kurdistan is a positive for U.S. strategy, and it's something that is a rare positive, to be honest. It doesn't seem so far that U.S. strategy has succeeded in doing much more than stopping the ISIS advance. We'll see early next year when apparently there's going to be a assault on Mosul by the government forces, perhaps with some aid from U.S. air power. We'll see if the tide can be turned early next year.
One other point before we move on to Russia, and that is apparently now, let's see, the U.S. is about to add some more forces. We're going to go up to about 3,100 American troops and 5,000 other Americans who are in Iraq in various capacities. So, you know, we're edging back to a fairly significant presence in that country, which is probably going to be required for this Islamic State threat to be dealt with. Yeah. But speaking of war and wars that we thought were over, but that are not. I mentioned, of course, that Vladimir Putin gave his State of the Nation address, and he was very defiant about Crimea and so on, and he called it the Temple Mount of Russia, a reference to a holy site in Jerusalem in terms of how important it is to the Russian ethos. But just as he was delivering the speech, there was an attack by rebels in Grozny in Chechnya, Stephen, and 20 people killed. And that was the war that Putin sort of made his name with, you know, that when he first came in, that he was going to crush this rebellion. How is Putin doing? How do Russians think he's doing? And what does the future look like for him?
I was speaking to a senior White House official about this yesterday, and there is some concern that Putin is becoming more delusional and paranoid and using this kind of trope that the West is responsible for all Russia's problems. You know, it seems from the outsider's point of view that Putin is beset from all sides. You've got the violence in Grozny on the fringes of Russia. You have the international sanctions, which have been hurting Russia's economy, which was already in trouble because of the fall in oil prices. There's rising inflation in Russia. At this point, it's not come to a point where it's changing Putin's calculation. At some point, U.S. officials think maybe next year there'll be a point when Putin has to decide either whether to make concessions and try and ease the pressure on Russia from the West, try and diversify his economy a little bit more. There'd be payments coming due on Russian debt, which the Russians can't service because they don't have access to the international banking system. So there could come a sort of a crisis point. The problem that worries some people that, you know, follow Russia very closely is, does Putin then double down and become even more nationalistic and paranoid in order to sort of sustain his political base at home? You know, the Russian people are not getting an unvarnished view of this from the Russian media, which is heavily state-controlled. The question is whether the new sort of luxuries that Russians have become accustomed to since the Cold War years, consumer goods, a middle-class lifestyle, if the loss of that will put so much political pressure on Putin that he has to change course. But to me, it seems like that question is very much up in the air. And I think we're in for a more dangerous and tense period in U.S. and Western relations with Russia.
Chris, how do you see the U.S. relationship with Russia evolving now? And how do you think Putin, I mean, I don't know that you can call the man delusional. I mean, he has his point of view clearly, and it serves his interests politically. But there's some basic facts about inflation, about the collapse of the ruble, about this debt that Stephen mentioned, $650 billion that they can't refinance. How do you think he's going to react?
A couple of points. First of all, Putin has seen this movie before, and he knows how it ended the last time he saw it, and I'm sure he remembers. And so it's clear that they're taking some kind of plans and seeing the writing on the wall and changing. They canceled that oil pipeline in Russia, and then they canceled the high-speed rail.
That was going to go south, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
And they canceled the high-speed rail line. So they're noticing that they might need to scale back. But Putin sold the Russians a set of promises and goods and said, we are going to be strong and you are going to have a better life. Now he has to find the resources in order to make that happen. And there, it helps to have a press that will explain that to the Russian people. But they'll notice if those promises are not fulfilled. And Putin has been thumping his chest with the United States and looking strong. And I think these kinds of instances, when they come to a head, are probably going to give the United States some leverage in dealing with him in ways the United States might not have had for. But I don't see Putin necessarily just being a shrinking violet. That's not what he is in any way, even when faced with tough circumstances. So it's really going to be interesting and to see how he responds to this, because you can't deny certain circumstances of the economy. And then we've seen the lowering of gas prices or oil prices, and that has not helped bolster the economy. So everything is kind of coming together at one time. And so 2015, I think, is going to be a fascinating year to see how Russia responds and if Putin is able to fulfill his big promises he made over the past few years.
We'll have more in just a minute. First, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Barbara Slavin of AllMonitor.com. Joining me today are Chris Moody and Stephen Collinson of CNN Politics. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. The program is also available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/issues in the news. Just a little bit more about Russia, about their situation. I was in Russia in, I guess it was 1998, when the ruble last collapsed. And people were hoarding dollars. They would change them into rubles just at the last minute, and you would do it at $5 and $10 at a, you know, pop, so as not to be stuck with a lot of rubles because the value just kept dropping. Stephen, the price of oil is down below $70 a barrel. The Russians apparently need it to be $100 a barrel to balance their budget. It seems to me that something is going to have to give politically, that as much as Putin wants to project a strong image, he can't defy reality forever.
That's basically the calculation the U.S. and the West is making. One sort of indication of how much the Russians are sort of isolated in this is that there are Russian officials have been pressuring European governments on the issue of sanctions, and particularly they've been trying to enlist the support of European business leaders to relax the sanctions. So while it's clear that sanctions haven't yet changed Russian behavior in Ukraine, it is clear that the Russians are very worried about their impact. So I guess at some point there's going to be a crisis point, but, you know, let's remember that, you know, Russia is a nation that's endured all sorts of deprivation over 100 years and more. I mean, I think the tolerance of the Russian people for deprivation and their susceptibility to a message that, you know, it's all the West's fault might be a lot more robust than perhaps we in the West think it might be. And I think there we have to be careful not to look at what the calculations that Putin's making and the political situation in Russia from a Western perspective, because I think the political currents are different. And it's a, you know, President Obama's logic is, well, none of this makes any sense for Russia at all. But, you know, the Russians are playing a different game and a different logic, and that that makes it a very difficult sort of situation to predict.
Yeah, indeed. I'm going to turn, Chris, to the Middle East and to the situation in Egypt. We don't talk about it very much these days, but there was a striking court decision recently where a court in Cairo, a judge in Cairo, decided to dismiss corruption charges against Hosni Mubarak and his two sons. Now, this appears to be subject to appeal, but there's lots of reports in the Egyptian press that Mubarak is going to go free very soon. How does that feel after, what is it now, coming on 4 years after Mubarak was overthrown?
You're talking about a lot of sacrifice that went into a greater hope for peace and for freedom in Egypt. And so a ruling like this is incredibly discouraging for the people who have worked toward this for the past several years. It's incredibly disheartening. I mean, in a way, a lot of the stories that came out of Egypt were people just giving up and saying, well, that's it. The fight is over. We have lost. And I think that that's not necessarily completely true. There's always continued back and forth. But you know, they have hope of an appeal. It'll be the third and final appeal that they can have for this, and they're going to try to go after that. But Mubarak is going to be in prison for, let's say, maybe a few more months into next year, and if the appeal doesn't work out, he will
walk free. I may have misspoken. This acquittal may have had to do with the charge against him for being responsible for those 800 deaths.
And then they were charging for 200 of those, I
right.
believe.
He had already served a time for the corruption charges. So
those run out next year.
Those are the ones that run out last year. So forgive me for misspeaking on that. I think that what's so stark is that while they exonerate him for responsibility for the deaths of innocent Egyptians. They're continuing to announce these death sentences, Stephen, against supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood. In this case, this death sentencing case, these people were not necessarily even involved in killing the policemen. They were just considered to be supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood, which has been outlawed, which is considered responsible for the violence.
Yeah, it's a very sort of depressing state of affairs. You know, we were talking about the Russian economy. Well, the Egyptian economy is in an absolutely appalling state. There's literally no hope if you're a young Egyptian getting a better life. But if you look at the U.S. response to this, which has been somewhat
muted, what has that
muted,
response been?
I think you could say it seems to me that we're going back into that sort of situation where the U.S. is prioritizing its geopolitical and national security interests in relationship with Egypt. You know, the fact that this is the premier Arab power, the fact that the rest of the Middle East is absolutely falling apart, and, you know, the U.S. has an interest in stability in Egypt, and it's prioritizing those goals perhaps over its more sort of its own founding ideals for freedom and the spread of democracy. It's a kind of balancing act the Obama administration has been doing, you know, ever since the revolution in Egypt. At one moment it looks like it's going one way, at one moment it looks like it's going the other. One thing I would say, though, is that, you know, Washington doesn't have the influence in Cairo that it did years ago. The Egyptians are not now just dependent on American money for armaments and for propping up their government. They got a lot of money from the Saudis, I believe, from the Gulf states. So it is a sort of a symptom of how the Middle East has changed and how the United States just simply doesn't have the ability to dictate outcomes and that it did in the past.
Yeah, very much so. But, you know, I think this week we're going to take a little bit of time to talk about domestic politics in the United States as well, because while we are very free with our criticism of other countries' human rights policies, it's pretty clear now that, and has been clear, I'm sure, to many people for a very long time, that we don't have equality of justice in this country. Chris, these cases of unarmed black men, sometimes children, being killed by police have really shocked the conscience of the nation in a way that I don't remember since the days of Rodney King back in Los Angeles, before you were born, I would imagine.
Oh, I was I grew up in Los Angeles, actually.
Yeah. And even going farther back to the riots we saw in Washington in the 1960s during the height of the Civil Rights Movement when Martin Luther King was killed and so on. People, I think, are beginning to get it now that although progress has been made, although we have an African-American president, it's not exactly changing the situation for millions of particularly young black men who are facing this kind of treatment from the police on a daily basis.
There are many Americans who before, I think a month ago, had absolutely no understanding of the different type of relationships that many young black men in urban settings have with police officers, whereas maybe an upper middle class Caucasian person might have a positive view of the police. That's because all of their experiences have been positive. But there, it really is very different in a lot of places where there's mistrust between the police forces and the people that they are policing, and their job is to serve and protect those people. And so we've had three flashpoints, the one in Ferguson, now the chokehold,
right,
in New York, and then I believe it was in Cleveland,
right,
in Ohio, where a 12-year-old was playing with an airsoft gun and a police drove up and shot him. Two of these three are on video camera. Mm-hmm. The Ferguson one is not. And I think when you have the cameras there, it allows to show a lot more of the details, and people, different types of people, can rally around the New York chokehold and the shooting in Cleveland in ways that Ferguson divided a lot of people.
Right, because we don't really know who was responsible. Yeah.
Right, and so with these flashpoints, with these examples, people will wake up to this realization and say maybe we should reconsider how criminal justice plays out, and that maybe there have been some long-standing problems that we just haven't been aware of or haven't bothered to look into. And at the end of all this, it's bringing consciousness to a lot more people, and that's, at the end, is a positive thing despite the tragedies that has befallen.
Yeah, one of the phenomena, Stephen, has been a Twitter, do you call it a meme or just a hashtag, criming while white, where thousands and thousands of white individuals have been tweeting about the crimes that they committed and got away with,
right,
because they were white. You know, whether it was being caught for drunk driving or having some sort of altercation with the police that if you were black could have resulted in being killed. In this case, you got off scot-free. So some consciousness raising?
Definitely. you know, social media was a key driving force behind a lot of these spontaneous demonstrations we've seen in New York, in Washington, and other cities, especially since the New York incident. It does seem that there is rising public consciousness. I think there's reason to believe that, you know, we have several probes. The Justice Department is looking into this. The New York authorities are looking into this. I think there's some reason to think that we might see some changes in police procedure, at least. The pictures of this man, Eric Garner, being, you know, choked basically on camera in daylight in New York have really shocked the nation. The question, though, is, are we going to see a change in the fact that, you know, race still is a very divisive factor in this country? I think that's more of a, you know, a much more generational issue that's going to take...
And an economic and class
issue
as definitely. Well.
Yes, definitely. And it's not something that some commission can come along and fix.
Mm-hmm. And not only choked on camera, but lying there dying and have no one provide aid to him. Instead, they rifle through his pockets.
Oh, my God.
And you know, they kind of poke at the man. And that's really, it's outrageous. I remember, I'm thinking of the Cleveland video, and it's on a security camera. When I was a child, we had those same kind of toy guns, and we took off the little orange thing because it looked really cool. And I remember playing in the front yard with my friend with the guns, and I remember a police officer pulling up, looking at us, noticing that we were just playing with toys and driving away. A very different experience for me.
Yes, indeed.
This child. And it's important that people have an awareness that people in the United States, different people, have different lives, and that affects their perspective of institutions like police and government. And that lack of awareness should be eroding, and I hope it does.
Yeah. One positive suggestion that's been made is that police all wear little body cameras so that whenever there is an incident in dispute, there will be a record of it. And also the hope is that that would act as a sort of restraint on the behavior of both the police and the person with whom they are dealing. But certainly this is a topic that is not going to go away anytime soon. So that's all the time we have. Joining us today were CNN Politics reporter Stephen Collinson and Chris Moody. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Barbara Slavin, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. Thanks for listening.
From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Issues in the News. You can email your questions or comments to our panelists. Send them to voanews@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune in the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us next week at this time for Issues in the News.